And we want programs to work. And so that means it needs to work for all of the people. And so that requires a mindset, a focus. And quite frankly, you have to be deliberative. You have to realize and ask for, well, why is person X or group Y not succeeding like the average? And what are the barriers or what are the obstacles that are particularly important and relevant for that group?
Welcome to Management Matters, a National Academy of Public Administration podcast where policy meets practice. I'm Terry Girton, president of the Academy. Our grand challenge focus for February is to connect individuals to meaningful work. And in this episode, I'll talk with Dr. Ed Montgomery about the intersection of workforce policies and actual employment. Ed is the president of Western Michigan University and an Academy Fellow. Ed, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me on the program, Terry. I look forward to today's conversation.
Well, I am so excited because we've got a lot to talk about, and this is my favorite grand challenge. And so I just can't get enough of the conversations around it. But let's start with your professional background, because your research has focused on many aspects of the labor market: economic growth, wage determination, productivity, social insurance. What are the major trends and challenges that you see in the current labor market in the United States?
Well, so I think there's the short run picture of what does it look like today, and then what do we expect to happen over the course of the next 5, 10, 15 years. Today, the labor market remains remarkably robust. We created, I think, 220,000 or so jobs last month, as we seem to have been doing each of the last couple of months. We've created over 3 million jobs in the last year. The labor market still is showing signs of shortages. There are, I think, almost 2 vacancies for every unemployed worker. The vacancy rate's at nearly record highs. And so employers are still talking about labor shortages. At the same time, the Federal Reserve has been on a conscious policy to slow the economy, to raise interest rates. And that will, at some point, start to drain some of the strength from the labor market, and we'll see a slowing in that growth. So right now, remarkably robust the labor market, labor shortages in most regions of the country, some shortages in almost every industry. Yes, there's some news of high tech, big tech people having layoffs and Facebook and so forth like that. But by and large, the labor market remains remarkably robust. Now, it's not robust for everybody, and the long-term picture has some continual challenges in it. The long-term picture is going to be shaded to a large degree by those twin big forces of globalization and technological change, both of which are going to change and continue to change who's in demand. It's going to change the quality of jobs. It's going to change the locations of jobs. And so if we're thinking about preparing people for the workforce, we have to think about how do we prepare them for today when there's shortages, but also how do we prepare them for the long term and tomorrow when there will be forces which might very well get rid of many of the jobs, particularly in the middle to lower skill part of the economy that people rely on today.
Well, you've raised a number of questions there, and I'm going to try to take them in a little bit of an order, but let's talk about the job creation aspect first in the short term, because I think we would all agree it's good to have jobs, and a tight labor market benefits a lot of people. But our grand challenge is to connect people to meaningful work, not just jobs, right? And so when you think about meaningful work, what does that term mean to you? Is it a quality job? Are those the same things? How do you, as a labor economist, define meaningful work?
Well, so I think there are 2 aspects to meaningful and quality, which are similar, but not necessarily exactly the same. Part of meaningful is, does it give me, the worker, a sense of purpose, a sense of well-being? And we know that working has a powerful effect in terms of people's income, but it also helps to give them a sense of identity, a sense of who they are. There are lots of studies that continue to go on out there that shows that people put a lot of value on that identity part. And what is the job and what is the purpose of the job? And so that's very subjective. I could get lots of satisfaction out of helping other people. Other people can get lots of value out of being part of an organization which is saving the environment or making some other kinds of change that reflects the values that they have. And so what is a meaningful job is one that fits your purpose. A lot of what higher education is talking about, what we're talking about as a university, is how do we help you find that major? How do we help you find that job, which gives you a sense of purpose? Because purpose makes it all worthwhile, helps us get over those inevitable barriers, helps us keep striving. So there's an aspect of how do you find and align people with their purpose. Most purposeful jobs will be quality, because one of the aspects of quality is you're doing something that to you has value to it. There are other aspects of quality in addition to that. Do you get paid a reasonable living wage? Do you get paid? Do you have benefits that allow you to have health care and a pension to retire on? Are you in an environment that is safe and so you're not risking your life? Those are other aspects of a quality job. There, it's both the employers, the worker, and a third actor, the government, plays a role in making sure those are matched. So that quality job, that purposeful job is partly each of our individual responsibilities, because we define what's purposeful and meaningful to ourselves. Partly it's a function of the education system, both at the college level and the high school level and pre-K. Are we prepared? Do we have the skills to do that? Partly it's a function of the job training system. Because I may have started out and I had the skills to do this thing in 2022, but now it's 10 years later. Do I still have the skills? And that's where the workforce system plays a big role. Community colleges can play a big role in that lifelong learning, making sure I'm continually able to do that. And of course, the government can play a role in terms of what it regulates, what it allows to have happen, what it mandates in terms of employers to have or offer as benefits. All of those things go into the ecosystem, which defines or helps determine the quality of jobs, whether they're purposeful or not. So it's sort of a brew, a stew that we're making with many different actors playing an important role.
Well, certainly the onset of the pandemic, when suddenly people lost their jobs or couldn't define their jobs, really sparked a conversation around what is meaningful work and quality jobs. How have you seen the conversation since 2020 change or take on these topics? Have you seen it move, or are we just rehashing the same concerns over and over?
No, I think it was an inflection point. I think it, for many people, one, losing their ability to go to their employment, two, being in many cases shut at home or being isolated from your workers, from your fellow coworkers, made people think about what is it about this job I like or I don't like? Where does it fit in my life? Have I got balance? And so we got what many people have referred to it as the Great Resignation or a quitting in place. That turnover increased dramatically, saw that the labor force participation rate dropped, still hasn't recovered completely back to where it was, despite a very strong economy. The share of people employed hasn't quite recovered to where it was. The amount of hours in total people are working hasn't recovered to where it had been. And so some of that is people looking at their employment relations and asking, is it fulfilling what I need and what I want? And employers were initially very willing to have those conversations because they needed to get workers back and they were forward leaning about it. Recently, we've seen in the cases of a number of employers an increased call to come back to the office. Many of that, particularly in the tech sector, which gets a lot of publicity, but there's a proposal, I believe, in front of Congress now to require all government workers to come back to the office at least 4 days a week or more. And so employers are saying, maybe they're not sure that we didn't overcorrect in terms of letting people work from home and the utility of that. It remains to be seen how workers will respond to that. I know in some sectors and nonprofits I'm with, people said, I quit. If you make me come back, I won't do it. whether they'll drop out of the labor force or they'll just go look for another employer, which will give them that flexibility, remains to be seen. But I think it's an ongoing conversation. I think the pendulum swung towards a lot of flexibility, partly because we got used to it, and then it's swinging back. I don't think we'll go 100% back to where we were in 2019 or early 2020, because I think people are looking at that bargain. I think this newer generation, and I'll say it based on what we see in terms of college students, are very much purpose-driven. They want to have a stronger sense of that they're making a difference. And they look to their job as not, it's great because it pays me a lot of money. They're looking for, yes, they want pay, but they're also looking for that meaning part, that purpose part. I wouldn't be surprised that it doesn't completely swing back, that the employers will continually have pressure to offer a better work-life balance, to be more family-friendly, to be more flexible in terms of where work gets done, how it gets done. And so that will be permanent. And of course, you'll overlay that with what's going to go on in the economy. You know, we still have talked about the power of artificial intelligence to change the employment relations for many, many jobs, which we think are important, truck drivers, et cetera. And we've just scratched the surface about that in that frame. And so those technological changes will interact with preferences to make tomorrow, the future, more cloudy.
Well, I want to chase that AI rabbit for a minute, if you'll let me, because as you were talking about the changes in how people approach their work that the pandemic initiated, certainly a couple of new words entered the vocabulary: frontline workers and essential workers, right? We suddenly realized that the folks who stock the shelves in the grocery store can't do that remotely, but if somebody doesn't come in and do that, nobody else gets to buy groceries. Or, you know, the folks who are working in restaurants or retail, and the value of those frontline workers. And of course, the essential workers like healthcare providers and, you know, other sorts of first responders, that there are some jobs that can't be done remotely. But the AI introduction is starting to change even some of those presumptions. How are we in the United States labor market prepared to weather and respond to those sort of massive changes in the market, both in the supply side and the demand side?
I think we will have challenges. I think dealing with the unknown, dealing with what we might call structural shifts, are hard, because our institutions that grow up and develop are developed to deal with, I'll call it, yesterday's problem. And this may be tomorrow's problem. If you think that some of the reports that talk about the potential for AI to displace tens and tens of millions of people, you may need a whole different social safety net. You may need to rethink what a guaranteed income is. You may need to rethink how much of people's lives they spend engaged in at least paying work as opposed to other types of activity. So that's a hard thing for our systems to adjust. Our systems are having a hard of tough time keeping up with the steady paces of change that's going on. Our workforce system is in many places is not as robust as it should be. We know that the people who are often hardest to serve, who are highest unemployed, who have not had the wage growth, are typically less educated, often middle to lower skilled individuals. Those will be the first people to be displaced. How do we have systems in place to re-employ them? Do we have both a robust social safety net to protect them while they're making the adjustments, and adjustment mechanisms to help them? Do we have training programs, both short and long-term programs, that come in, meet people where they need to be, deliver them, and then can help them get back in the labor market? We made some changes in this country. We're nowhere near as flexible as we should be. And I'll take my experience during the Great Recession, when many auto plants closed around the country. You had mass layoffs. And we weren't prepared to deal with that. We weren't prepared in towns which lost their major source of employment to get them back into the game quickly. And so that takes a all hands on deck system. It takes a workforce system. It takes a small business system. It takes thinking about finance and capital. It thinks about technology and job creation. What are the new industries? All of those things have to work hand in glove much better if you want to be able to deal with the kind of big changes AI is predicted to make. And so we have some time. We don't have a ton of time to start working on and making sure our system can handle that kind of stress. Because if it delivers that promise, let's just do, it delivers the promise to automate driving. You think about all the jobs that where somebody drives somebody or drives some goods, and now all of a sudden we don't need those people.
Well, the example of the auto workers crisis and the Great Recession is a great one. It brings in globalization, it brings in technology change, it brings in training and retraining and community development and all kinds of things. Of course, one of the things we love to do in the United States is pick a person or an organization and say, it's their problem to solve, right? It's not my problem. It's someone else's problem and someone should fix it. So when you think about this, one of the things that strikes me is we don't really have a national workforce development strategy. Should we? First question. And second question, if we should, who should put that strategy together? Whose job is it to solve that problem?
Well, you know, the honest answer is we don't have a single person. Part of what we set up during the Great Recession to deal with the auto crisis was something very much like they have at the base closure. We recognized that it was an interagency needed. We needed people from the Labor Department to talk about job training. We needed people from HUD to talk about housing and what would happen then. We needed people from HHS to talk about how do we take care of healthcare and those barriers that come along with that. We needed people from education because we needed to get people back into workforce or to train the next generation. We needed people from Treasury because there would be issues of financing and how do we put these packages together? If we're going to attract new companies, we needed people from commerce. We needed people from the energy department. And so it really needed to be a cross-government, multi-agency effort, almost a hands on deck to say, we all have an aspect of this problem. If you're really going to solve the problem, if you're going to help do the transition, it's not enough to make sure that Johnny or Mary has skills. That's certainly a big part of it. But you got to make sure that Johnny and Mary can get to the job. Well, that could be a transportation problem. You got to make sure they can stay on that job. That could be a healthcare problem. You got to make sure they can stay on the job. That could be a childcare problem. You need to make sure their house is accessible to the place of work. So that's a housing problem. So it really, if we're going to think about this thing and really be prepared, we have to not only think about the individual components, we have to think about the overlap so that we're getting the worker side prepared. At the same time, we've got to get the employer side because people don't pay attention to the fact that there are companies who will be going through adjustments. Some will be new people entering the market. How do you make sure you get the new guys in? How do you make sure they're up to speed? How do you make sure they can grow? But then there'll be other companies who need help transitioning. And so things like manufacturing extension service and other kinds of programs are supportive of companies making that change. And so both sides of the world had to change. There were lots of auto workers who needed to change and make the transition, but there were also part suppliers, auto companies, dealers, who also had to change. And so to get both sides of the equation and then the community in which they operate had to be able to change. And so it takes a holistic system. Who should be in charge? I personally like the notion of some kind of coordinator. That doesn't mean that that person runs all those other agencies and they pull those things out because there's something about the expertise in each agency, which is necessary. What you need somebody to do is to make sure people play nice in the sandbox and work out those kinks, which inevitably arise when the rules of program A don't work with the rules of program B or meet the real world, which needs maybe a different operating premise C. And so I think there's some utility to having an interagency work group, to be honest with you.
Well, as we say in our grand challenges, no current government problem can be solved by any one agency or any one level of government, because exactly as you describe, every piece of the government mechanism, including all the levels of government, really needs to come together. And it strikes me as you were describing that, that we can do that in a crisis. So we can respond, or the auto plants shut down and we needed to solve that problem. We could pull by force of intent all of those different pieces together, but we're not really good at thinking about it for the future and planning in advance. What guidance would you have for somebody who might get named the coordinator of the National Workforce Strategy? Where would they start?
A lot of this starts with dimensioning the problem and knowing what's already there. I think the danger with a coordinator is to say, well, I need to have my own. And so I'm going to duplicate what they're doing at, you know, HUD or EPA or Commerce or Small Business Administration or Interior, wherever it is. And I think that's a mistake. This position really does need to be somebody who takes those resources at the federal level and, quite frankly, figures out how do I work with the state and the local levels. Because across the three levels, there are often lots of resources. There often are programs that don't link up as well as they should. And so part of what this person's job is to have a set of people who can make those linkages, who can help coordinate them, who can help smooth out the differences or look for how do we smooth out the differences, because one agency defines it this way and another agency defines it in a different way. We're still talking about the same apple, but we're defining it as different in different terms. And so that person really needs to have, or that set of people need to have, this coordination function, coordination mindset, and a real willingness to rely on and call on and get the expertise that's already embedded in many of the agencies, but right now is all trained towards operating in their own respective silo. And I say that lovingly, having been at the Labor Department, and I love that silo, but it's a silo. So the Labor Department and the Department of Education, they should be hand in glove. Just to name two. And so how do we get that better? How do we make that system work better? Because they both feed each other. And so that I think is really the key part of the thing, less about who has the money. And some of it, quite frankly, in an emergency, what happens is it becomes very clear that this is about something the president has said is important, and people respond to if the chief executive says it's important and then acts as if it's important, then other agencies will respond appropriately and help us plan it. So it takes a concerted effort if we're going to think about it as an over the horizon problem, and also a willingness to delegate power.
Well, we've been talking a lot here about the functions at the federal level. But you mentioned earlier in your comments the national workforce system. So, and that's really something that's operated at the state and local government level. So what options do states and communities have when they're thinking about their economic development strategies to really create pipelines to meaningful work?
What I will say is, if you look back at the experience over the last 20 to 30 years, a lot of the real innovation on workforce and education policy actually happened at the local level. It was, in many cases, governors or sometimes mayors who came up with an idea or a program or an innovation for their local community that worked. And then other people said, oh, that's great. Let's copy it. And whether you're thinking about welfare to work or a variety of other labor market programs that have helped people make the transition, get activated, make a way to think about it, is we've learned from each other. So we have 50, 51 laboratories, if you will, if you think about the states and the District of Columbia, who are capable of being innovators. They should be empowered to be innovators. They should be empowered to help us learn from what they did some of which won't work. And that's important, just as finding out what does work is important. And so finding a way, if the federal government is going to do anything, it's to incentivize them to do those experiments, incentivize them to try risk, to try different things, to see what works in South Dakota or Wisconsin or Georgia, as well as in D.C. and New York and California. And some states like California are so big, or Texas, you might have two different or three different kinds of systems innovating in their context. So freeing up, empowering states to be innovators, I think, is one of the best ways we can get social reform or social innovation, policy innovation going from the government. And states can play a big role in it. And obviously mayors can as well. They're often, mayors are at the very front line. They're the mothers of invention. If we can get, here's a sector we talked about a little bit when we were doing the auto stuff, but doesn't get as much appreciated. There's a nonprofit and charitable foundation sector. They often will resource efforts. They'll resource experiments. Obviously, we hear the big places like the Gates Foundation. But in many communities, there is a local foundation that has the power. They can play a role in incentivizing and helping structure local efforts to be innovative and be a part of it. And so figuring out how those local efforts, those local experiments, some run by a charitable organization, some run by local foundation, can be part of the stew of getting innovation going at the local, bubbling up to the state level, bubbling up to the federal level. I think we need to look at the rules around how people can operate and figure out, are there ways to coordinate it better? Because the objectives of having a well-functioning labor market system are the same. They just do it in different ways in different spaces. And I'm not talking about co-opting them. I'm figuring out, how do we cooperate better?
Well, I love the discussion about the 51 laboratories of democracy, because really the economies in those states are all so different. And we are seeing some innovation. We have a couple of states now, including Pennsylvania and Maryland, who've try to eliminate the degree requirements for their state government positions and go to a skills-based job description model. And we're starting to hear conversations about that on the private sector side as well. Is that an innovation, and should we be trying to test that and advance that?
Sure. I mean, there's some interesting work that's looking at whether credentialization is, have we gone too far with credentialization? Is it a barrier? Is it a barrier for certain types of workers, minorities, women, or is it a barrier for certain skill levels of workers? And so there's been some interesting innovation, particularly in the rapidly changing IT area, that would suggest that a BA degree or an MA degree is less the issue and less the clear cut the way to differentiate worker quality, and that you could actually measure it by certificates, skill competencies, and that it would be more efficient both for the worker, because then they wouldn't have to invest in something that isn't really useful to them. And for the employer, they would get access to workers who maybe can't afford a four-year degree from Stanford, but can't afford to go to Bridgeport Community College or Kalamazoo Valley Community College around here and get a certificate and fit that job. Particularly for jobs that are skills that don't last that long, you don't want to say want to make a four-year investment in skills that last 2 years. I remember going to a LinkedIn conference and they talk about the average half-life of technology skills is 2.5 years. Well, a college degree is 4 years. So if that's even remotely the case, by the time you're a senior, you're already obsolete. and so I think thinking about what are the skills that are better achieved over the longer term, over the course of those programs? What are the skills which are really short-term competencies? And thinking about how do we deliver them? And it may not be the same mechanism that delivers best. I think colleges and universities are much better at giving what are the long-term skills? What are the things that are going to be cross-cutting across many, many technologies? The things which are short-term, which are dependent on this technology, we gear up and we move at a much too slow pace. So there's a room for either community colleges, training things, certificates, competency-based things to play a role, depending on what an employer meets. So on one hand, the competency can be very democratic and make some of the barriers to acquiring skill less. I would caution us, however, not to get focused just on the short term, because we all age. We're all going to be any 20-year-old, 18-year-old hopes to be in the labor market 30, 40 years. And so we will often, as we know, change jobs half dozen plus times. We may change careers multiple times. What the careers look like will change multiple times. So you need to prepare people both for the job of today and then that future trajectory. So we don't want to set it up as an either or. I would say we need to set it up as a both and.
Both and. That's a really great framing to keep us focused on, like, what are the requirements today? And just kind of as we wrap up, I want to circle back to some things we talked about early on about meaningful work, quality jobs, and the complexity of making sure that someone can not only get a job, but hold a job. And so as we think about all the complexities of the labor market and how we want to move people to meaningful work, how do we center all of these strategies in equity? And how do we measure equitable outcomes around meaningful work and employment?
Yeah, I think this is a real challenge. Economists might call it heterogeneity. You know, often it's easy to design a policy for the average person. And on average, it works. On average, it's the right thing to do. And all of that may be absolutely true. And that's not trivial to do to do that. But we're not average. We're all different. And we're maybe not average on all dimensions. Some things I care intensely about, you may not care about at all, and vice versa. There are skills that I bring to the table that you may not, and that you bring to the table that I might not. And so when we think about people and human beings, we realize that we're heterogeneous individuals, and we come from different histories and packages. And so there are populations that, even in a good economy like we have now, where the unemployment rates, you know, under 4%, 3.7, 3.6, the unemployment rate for African Americans still almost 6%. And similarly, the differences between high skilled and low skilled, college educated and not, we have heterogeneity in the labor market. And so making sure that we're not just making an economy and systems that work for the average person, but making sure we also look at those, that distribution, and that we don't have significant gaps between the achievement or outcomes for people of different populations, of different abilities. And so that requires purposeful attention. So making sure that equity is a central part is really looking at that heterogeneity. We said we as policymakers, we as the government are here to serve the people, then that means all of the people. And so how do we be inclusive in the programs that we want? And we want programs to work. And so that means it needs to work for all of the people. And so that requires a mindset, a focus. And quite frankly, you have to be deliberative. You have to realize and ask for, well, why is person X or group Y not succeeding like the average? And what are the barriers or what are the obstacles that are particularly important and relevant for that group? And so they may not be the big things on average, but they may be intensely important. So, you know, one of the things we discovered here, you know, many of our students work their way through college. And because they work their way through college and often are making big investments, they're often in a very fragile economic position. And I had a young man who came up to me and he said, somebody stole the catalytic converter on my car. And because I couldn't afford to get it fixed, I couldn't make my job. Because I couldn't make my job, I'm dropping out of college. So this guy is a senior. He can see the finish line. And the cost of a catalytic converter was the difference between his ability to stay in college. That's not in the scheme of things, that's not a huge sum of money. But we have to realize that different people are often in very fragile pockets and they can get knocked off the track. And so do we have a system that works for that kind of student or somebody else who has a different type of story around why they haven't been able to be as successful as we would like them to be?
That is a perfect encapsulation of the glorious complexity of our national labor market and system and the unique individual concerns that sometimes keep people from being as successful as they want to be. So, Ed, thank you for sharing that and your enthusiasm for this system. And thank you for the work you're doing with the next generation there at Western Michigan. And thanks for joining me today on the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
We'd like to give a special thanks to our sponsors. This week's Management Matters is brought to you in part by Academy Fellow Judy Douglas. If you'd like to join her in sponsoring the Management Matters electronic newsletter and podcast, please contact our development team at development@napawash.org to learn more. For our listeners, check back every Monday for a new episode from the Academy as we work to build a just, fair, and inclusive government that strengthens communities and protects democracy.